Before we get started, I want to send out a big thank you again to the Peyto team for another great quarter. You know, we've had another very busy quarter, third quarter, and I think the team has again been successful driving down costs and maintaining our profitability on our capital investments, even during these low commodity price environments. So a great big thank you out to the team. In the room with me today is all of the Peyto management team, consisting of Scott Robinson, our Chief Operating Officer, Kathy Turgeon, our CFO. We've got Dave Thomas, our VP Exploration, JP Lachance, our VP Engineering, Tim Louie, our VP of Land, Lee Curran, our VP of Drilling and Completions, and Todd Burdick, our VP of Production. And of course, we also have Jim Grant, our Investor Awareness Rep here. And Jim, we've had, even in the short timeline, some questions coming through from shareholders, so why don't I turn them over to you?
Okay. For those of you who are new to our conference calls, we hold the first half as a question and answer session where I ask some of the senior management questions about Peyto and its latest financials before we turn the call over to questions from investors and representatives of investment businesses. Darren, mixed with negatives like the lowest commodity prices in years, TCPL pipeline issues, are positives like we drilled more, added more production, continued to post a profit, and generate returns from our activities in the third quarter. What is the secret sauce? Why are we going one direction while everyone else seems to be taking a different branch in the road?
Yeah, Jim, you know, I think Peyto is definitely standing out in this environment. You know, we've often talked about how our behavior tends to be a bit opposite to that of the industry. We tend to zig when the industry is zagging, and in this particular environment, for instance, we're tending to invest quite aggressively while the industry is really dialing back a lot of its activity. You know, that's because we know that the key to generating better returns for our shareholders is to spend less in developing our reserves and production. And when the industry isn't busy like it is now, everything costs less. I think, you know, that's pretty evident simply just looking at our drilling and completion costs. What was costing us, you know, sort of $4.5 million per well last few years is costing us close to $3 million a year per well this year, and those savings obviously directly enhance our returns. The secret sauce, as you say, I think, is being able to do this when commodity prices are low, and that's as a direct result of us having such high margins. You know, we are the lowest cost producer, and so we have the most cash flow to invest in the down cycle. And so we get to buy the most when it's on sale. You know, we all know these sales won't last, so we got to get them while we can.
Okay. Turning to Todd Burdick, our VP of Production. Todd, despite ongoing issues with TCPL pipeline restrictions since last spring, I see we had a 16-day run over the end of October and early November, during which we were able to flow unrestricted and that we were able to exceed 100,000 barrels of oil a day. It was certainly nice to see that period without constraints. Can you provide more detail on the outlook here and forward for TCPL transportation over the balance of this year and into early 2016?
Yep. Jim, first I should point out that during that 16-day period, we saw our base wells perform better than they had prior to being either shut in or severely restricted. In fact, during this period, we had some facilities that were still restricted, either by meter station capacity or plant processing and compression limitations. We've recently picked up more service and are back over 100,000 BOE today. Barring any operational upsets, we expect to stay at this level until the latter part of the month. And after that, there is some uncertainty as to what TCPL will allow onto their system. And with regard to TCPL's activities, Q4, we have seen an increase in their capability to move gas. Most of the NEB-imposed D rates are now lifted, and they've done a lot of work debottlenecking the system in the upstream James River delivery area. We should also see more gas move off of the Grand Prairie main line onto the North Central Corridor once they commission a new compressor station in December. Again, this will provide even more capability to the upstream James River area. So far in Q4, we are seeing a high level of maintenance activity, which has been restricting deliveries to firm contract volumes and at times slightly below firm contract volumes. Indications are that most of the maintenance in this area will be complete by the end of November. It's our understanding that at this time, interruptible service should become available. Going into 2016, TransCanada have indicated that most of their maintenance work will be in areas outside of the upstream James River delivery area, so we don't anticipate any long-term impacts to our production.
Thank you. Turning to Scott Robinson, our VP of Operations and COO. Scott, we've seen prices in the third quarter drop to lows for gas to the levels of 2012 and for oil to the levels last seen in the sharp dip of 2008-2009. On top of that, propane prices have been negative during much of the last two quarters. How are we coping with these prices? What strategies do we have to mitigate some of the impacts of these prices on our product mix?
Yeah, it's pretty tough times when the commodity prices are where they are, Jim. But our focus is on cost control. As Darren highlighted, our margins are still very attractive. We've built this business since its inception on cost focus, and we've been able to excel at that. Our cost structure is really fortified by our infrastructure, which gives us a huge advantage over many of the other companies out there. And it's also strengthened by our dedicated operations staff who chisel away at every last penny to get production costs down to where they are. So over the years, we've kept those costs in the 25 to 30 cent range, and that gives us a huge advantage, a huge flexibility throughout all of these price cycles, from gas prices of $5 down to gas prices of $2, we're putting a positive margin out there. Some of the specific measures that we're looking at, obviously our hedging program, which has been a longstanding philosophy of the company for price smoothing, is playing a role this year, and it will next year. We've got price protection through the balance of this year at about 65% of our production. And next year, we've got about 40% of that production forward sold, which takes us up, it adds about 25 cents to our expected production price next year and takes us over the $3 MCF mark, which will give us positive margins again if these prices persist. Another measure that we've often spoke about over the past few quarters is the way we handle liquids recovery. Spoke about propane prices. We've been able to push propane back into the gas phase where it makes money as compared to losing money right now through the recovery of propane. And by changing the operating conditions of our plants, we've taken our propane recoveries. A year ago, they were about 30% of the incoming propane, of the incoming gas stream. 30% of the propane molecules were recovered as liquids. We've dropped that down to about 4% here, which has really diminished the amount of propane. And that rejected propane obviously is sold in the gas form and makes us a better net back there. So those are some of the things that we do. But really, it's all about costs and keeping that cost down and being, you know, on the low side of all of our competition cost-wise.
Great, thank you. Turning to our CFO and VP of Finance, Kathy Turgeon, while our debt level has grown gradually over the years to the current level, our interest expense per MCFE continues to drop. Can you give us the contributing factors to this?
Thanks, Jim. Our interest costs, both on a percentage basis and on a per MCFE basis, have indeed been decreasing. Our interest costs are comprised of an interest rate component based on the Bank of Canada rates, plus a variety of additional costs such as stamping fees, unutilized fees, extension fees, and other fees associated with credit spread, which are charged by the lender. As Peyto has grown and moved from a borrowing-based secured credit facility to an unsecured covenant-based credit facility, these costs have decreased. The decrease is a result of both an acknowledgement of the improved creditworthiness of Peyto itself and also as a result of competition between lenders. This on top of the ongoing low Bank of Canada rates has given us low borrowing costs.
Okay. Turning to our VP of Land, Tim Louis. Tim, in the third quarter, we were more active in asset acquisitions and dispositions than we have been for a while. Can you give us some more color on this?
Thanks, Jim. The third quarter definitely was an active period for both dispositions and acquisitions. In August and September, we closed two transactions to sell undeveloped lands in non-core areas. And by undeveloped, I mean there were no wells or production involved with these deals. A total of five sections were sold for $6.1 million. With respect to acquisitions during the quarter, Peyto spent $4.2 million at land sales to acquire 19 sections. To date, Peyto has spent $5.5 million for 37 sections. In addition to our land sale acquisitions, we closed deals earlier this year to purchase 14 sections of undeveloped lands for $3 million. So in total, our cumulative acquisition cost to date has been $8.5 million to acquire 51 sections. And this works out to an average cost of $260 per acre. When compared to last year's average acquisition cost of $522 per acre for 38 sections, you can see that Peyto has been able to acquire more acres this year for an average cost of roughly half of what was paid in 2014. There have also been some incidental benefits to being an active operator during this period of lower commodity prices. These benefits are not as obvious as a land sale or a direct purchase, and they come in two forms. The first benefit stems from wells where we have partners. If a partner elects not to participate in the Peyto operating well, their interest is then subject to a production penalty. Some of our partners have been unable to participate in joint wells due to reduced capital budgets. To date, we have been able to gain an additional 7.6 net wells through our partners' non-participation. We still have six more joint wells to drill before year end, so there is potential to earn additional wells via this process. The second benefit of being an active operator is derived from drilling on PNG or petroleum natural gas licenses. When drilling on a primary term license, validation credits are generated, which then are used to extend the license past its primary term. If you cannot validate a license, the license will expire and revert back to the Crown. There have been a few occasions where an adjacent mineral holder is not able to validate your license due to lack of drilling on their part. In those instances, we have been able to apply our validation credits to that company's expiring lands. By validating the license, we have been able to negotiate deals to earn 100% of that company's interest in exchange for a small override. By using this approach, Peyto has been able to earn six sections for zero incremental acquisition costs.
Great. Turning to Dave Thomas, our VP of Exploration. Dave, we just drilled a record number of horizontal wells in the last quarter and recently hit the 100,000 barrel of oil a day equivalent milestone. Can you provide some color on the wells we've planned for the remainder of 2015 and what our plans are to continue Peyto's strong drilling results in 2016?
Jim, our current plans have us spudding an additional 37 horizontal wells by mid-December to take us to the end of the year. These spuds will include 18 Wilrich, 12 Falares, 6 Nauticuans, and 1 Blue Sky well. Two of the Nauticuan spuds will be down at Brazeau. One will test a Nauticuan trend close to our Brazeau gas plant, but the second one will be drilled far out on the west side of our lands. This well was just licensed Tuesday, and it directly offsets a well recently drilled by a competitor, which the public data shows as averaging 10.6 million a day for the month of September. We think the same trend holds multiple Nauticuan drilling opportunities on our land, and we've mapped several more of these trends over our Brazeau land base of 121 sections. Our drilling program for 2016 is looking extremely similar to our successful 2015 program. It looks like we'll finish off 2015 having drilled 25 Nauticuans, 43 Falares, 66 Wilrich, and 8 Blue Skies for a total of 142 gross spuds. In 2016, we're planning 28 Nauticuans, 44 Falares, 64 Wilrich, and 7 Blue Skies for a total of 145 spuds. About 79 of these spuds will be in the Old Man Nose Hill Wild Hay area. 42 of them will be in the Edson Ansel Minehead area, and 24 will be down at Brazeau. It's not quite a carbon copy of 2015, but close, so we won't be messing much with success. For the second year in a row, we do not plan to include any Cardiums as they don't compete with our other projects in the current commodity pricing environment. Also similar to 2015, during which we shot a new 100% proprietary 3D at Ansel, we'll shoot a 3D program down at Brazeau in 2016 to complement our existing coverage there. I think our Brazeau gas plant is currently pinned at its 50 million a day, MCF a day maximum, and is waiting on some new compression. But with good drilling results, we'll likely build up some behind pipe volumes until the plant meter station expansion to 100 million a day is completed in late Q1 or Q2, or that depends on timing with TCPL. And we shouldn't forget we have a couple of hundred less glamorous middle flare inventory locations at Brazeau. Our last two middle flares there cost just $1.8 million and $1.9 million to drill and run liners, so it looks like we're just on the cusp of being able to develop this large flare inventory more aggressively. To sum up, Jim, although 2015 has been a challenging year for commodity prices and TCPL restrictions, it's been a very successful year for Peyto's drilling program, and the ingredients are there for us to do well or better in 2016.
Thanks, Dave. Scott, with the new government in Alberta, we've seen some changes already to the rules that businesses operate under in Alberta, but more fundamental changes may be coming with the review of royalty rates. From your involvement with this process, what can you tell us about the changes we may see?
I can't really say much, Jim. I have been involved on the side with an industry group, but we as Albertans, we're all waiting to hear the results. The process seems to be going very well. It's been very well planned and executed by an extremely competent and capable panel of people who are in charge. And they've sought the input of a large cross-section of Albertans from all walks of life. And it seems, you know, the panel seems to be focused on the right things. The new government should be very, very well informed to make the decisions that lie ahead that they've suggested will come by the end of the year here. I think one key point that the panel seems to have really grasped and understand is that the need to position Alberta's industry to compete with an extremely formidable U.S. competition base for the market share. And therefore, the government needs to be very mindful of any impediments that they might or could possibly put in the way of that competitive situation. So there is another matter that I'll just deviate off on that's also at the forefront of our new government, and that's the focus on environmental performance. They started their term back in the summer by bumping up the cost of emissions, of CO2 emissions for large emitters. Without getting into any kind of discussion on the virtues or pitfalls of CO2, we do see extremely strong alignment between CO2 emissions and business cost performance. We've been focusing on this for a number of years through a number of initiatives, which in aggregate are reducing our operating costs and simultaneously reducing emissions. Reduced drilling costs by 4 or 5 days per well year over year. The execution of well stimulations is much more orderly and organized. The optimization and minimization of rig move distances, the way we run our gas plants, all those things are achieving measurable reductions in costs and emissions. One specific interesting part of this is our Old Man plant, which is based on its throughput. It's designated as one of the specified large emitters in Alberta, and having an emissions in excess of 100,000 tons per year, it gets measured on this new scale. Under the new regime, we're tasked to reduce the intensity of emissions from that facility, that is the amount of CO2 that is emitted per gas unit of gas that we process. We're tasked to reduce that by 15% for 2016 and 20% by 2017, or else we will be paying penalties of $20 and $30 a ton for 2016 and 2017 and thereafter. By way of process modifications that we are currently making, we expect to reduce our fuel gas consumption by over the 20% requirement, so we should pull this facility back to or below that 100,000 ton level, emissions level. And the real driver for that is that we're going to save about $1 million of fuel gas a year, and that's part and parcel of our focus on the business and the simultaneous achievement of some of these results. So I think we're measuring up to some of the requirements that lie ahead that our government is putting on our industry with regard to emissions.
Thanks for that, Scott. That's a lot to think about, but it sounds positive. My next question is for Lee Curran, our Vice President of Drilling and Completions. Lee, in our third quarter report, we suggest you may make further inroads in drilling and completion costs. Where were they in the third quarter, and what trends are we seeing as the winter starts up?
Thanks, Jim. As noted in our third quarter release, well cost reductions of approximately 25% as compared to 2014 have been realized throughout the previous two quarters. Of that 25%, service price reductions comprise approximately 15 to 18 points of the total 25, with the remaining 7 to 10 points being driven by technical advancements and performance gains. Service pricing reductions essentially stalled out through the summer months. However, more recently into the fall, pricing reductions have steadily been pursued and received, albeit at a much less significant rate than we had experienced coming into spring breakup. Certain cost elements that occupy a large percentage of our well construction costs, such as tubular fuels, have essentially flatlined, given the effect of a significantly devalued Canadian dollar as compared to where it was a year ago. Now, very recently, the Canadian Association of Oil Well Drilling Contractors posted a 5% labor reduction rate for rig workers. This, in addition to a 3% wage reduction posted earlier in the year, has brought drilling rig labor rates back to 2011 levels. Now, the CAODC wage schedule typically sets the bar for labor rates throughout various positions within the oil and gas service industries. As such, we would anticipate labor rates to continue to decline over the coming months. Based on recent rig utilization data, it would certainly appear that our industry is heading into an earlier than typical Christmas shutdown. Rig activity has begun to drop to levels approaching 20% utilization. This is very uncharacteristic of a typical activity level expected in November. Many of our service contractors have communicated that they continue to face significant hesitation from most operators in terms of their commitment to 2016 drilling programs. In the event we do not see a rebound of activity, even as low as 30 to 40% rig utilization, through the first quarter of 2016, we would anticipate another round of aggressive pricing competition. Now, in addition to these increased service discount levels that we are currently experiencing, we certainly attribute a meaningful portion of our performance gains to the simple fact that in today's highly competitive market, we have access to more competent, diligent, and experienced personnel. Continued low activity levels will certainly support this in the future. We are optimistic that continued collaboration with our service contractors on both the fronts of pricing and performance will yield continued well cost reductions. To remain profitable in an intensely competitive environment, our service providers will need to be innovative and will assist in the development of new technologies that will benefit both their bottom line as well as the bottom line of their customers.
Thank you, Lee. Turning to JP Lachance, our VP of Exploitation. JP, with all the work that we are doing optimizing the costs of drilling wells, what sort of production levels and expected reserves are we seeing from those wells, and how are the results of drilling these wells holding up against the current price deck?
Thanks, Jim. Your question is important in the context that we're bucking the trend, so to speak, being selective in this price environment. We recently spent a focused effort looking back at the results of the wells we've done over the first 9 months of this year. Our average well results have been better than forecast, with a rate improvement of roughly 16% over the first 90 days as compared to last year's average well. How this translates into reserves is to be determined, as it's still early in the life for a lot of these wells, although it does seem that the trend is sustained in the short term. This average well improvement can be attributable to some modest changes in well design, a little on the horizontals, a few more stages, but I think it's more to do with the location selection. A large contributor to this average increase in rates is coming from the Wilrich in the Brazeau area, where coupled with the Sundance-like cost structure has made for some very good returns. Now, that's not to say there are other areas and zones aren't holding their own. We're getting the repeatable, predictable results in the Spirit River zones and Sundance, while some of our best returns are coming from our program of flares in the Ansel and Edson area. When we look at the performance I described, and the actual cost we spent on the wells in the first three quarters, run on the current strip price, we are predicting an overall 20% rate of return on that program. Now, that would include costs we've spent on land and seismic and facilities to represent full cycle economics. The price used in this analysis is $2.50 a GJ for 2016. It doesn't include any value for the hedges that Scott described earlier. So, Jim, I would say our results are holding up pretty well in this current price environment.
Thank you, JP. Darren, one of the questions I get asked fairly frequently, and specifically it came in twice overnight, I'm going to choose the words from shareholder we have in Paris. You're certainly doing a great job, but unfortunately the gas price is not helping, and under spot prices, with no extra oil services cost deflation assumed, cash flows should not be high enough to cover your budgeted capex and dividend next year. Can you please tell me how high you are willing to let your gearing drift to defend your balance sheet? What should we expect you to diminish first, the dividend or the capex?
Jim, you know, it's a great question, and it's one that we get a lot, you know, asking about the funding for those two distinct things, our capital program and our dividend. And I think we have to think of, and we do think of, capital program funding and dividend funding quite differently. For our capital programs, or the opportunities that we have to generate a return on a capital investment, we can fund these in one of three ways. We can either use cash flow, debt, or equity. And we've used all three at various times in our history. Generally, we try to pick the sources that have the least cost to them. Obviously, our cash flow is first, and then it's usually debt or equity. And since we generate such a healthy full-cycle return on those investments, like JP just talked about, 20-plus percent, we can afford a little cost of capital for that external. Not too much, but a little. And we can use these sources of funding, cash flow, debt, and equity, to overspend a little and to take advantage when things are on sale, like they are today, as Lee talked about. You know, from those investments, then, we expect to generate a profit, which we typically measure in the form of earnings. And it's out of those profits that we fund the dividends to shareholders. So when we think about dividend funding, it's out of profits that we've generated. And depending on the quarter or the year, it's not always a perfect match. You know, generally, we've tried to get those pretty close. And over our history, I think we've done just that. We've generated approximately $1.9 billion in earnings cumulatively, and we've paid out $1.8 billion in dividends and distributions. So pretty well matched, I think. And really, this is always how we've approached it. But we've always been, I think, very mindful of our debt levels and our leverage. This overspend approach, or borrowing a little to take advantage of the lower-priced inputs that we have, it does only go so far. We still have to keep our total debt in check, and we still have to be comfortably within our debt covenants, obviously. But over the last 17 years, you know, we've never let our debt to cash flow, for instance, get over 2.5 times. So we've always kept our debt in check. And I think, you know, that's obviously an appreciation, a healthy appreciation for the fact that things in this industry are constantly changing. You know, so when we think about funding for our capital programs, we think about funding our dividends, we have to always keep in mind what changes we're seeing in the industry. Commodity prices are changing, costs are changing. So we have to constantly look back at the returns we're generating, at the profits we're generating, at the costs of all forms of the capital that we have to use, and at the profits that we're generating off of those investments, and how are we going to fund our dividends going forward. So, you know, that's easier for us to do. Obviously, we're a small company, 50 people. We can remain incredibly nimble, and we can always be responding quite quickly to changes in the industry. So, you know, as long as I think we're very cognizant of all those changes that are happening all the time, then I think we're always going to be fine when it comes to funding those respective pieces, the capital program and the dividends.
Okay. So, Darren, looking forward to 2016 with federal and provincial governments that seem, some see as radically different from the status quo in their platforms on wealth sharing and the environment, what do you think the impact will be on our business and the rest of the Alberta energy complex?
You know, to be honest, Jim, I'm personally a bit confused by some of the comments that come from these new provincial and federal governments that we have. The Alberta energy industry, I think it's extremely important to the quality of life that we as Albertans and we as Canadians get to enjoy. You know, as an industry, we provide secure, abundant, affordable sources of energy for all Canadians and for a lot of Americans too. And we do it, as Scott alluded to, in one of the most environmentally and morally responsible ways of anybody on the planet. So, you know, I find it quite odd that we have governments that want to put up roadblocks to the success of this industry and who, you know, come out and criticize our industry for its performance. I think it's perhaps because these political leaders were previously unaware of how important this industry really is. And they're previously unaware of how good a job we really do. You know, I think as they come to appreciate just how important we are to Canadians, and as they gain some perspective on how good a job we really do relative to other producing nations in the world, you know, I think we will start to see them come around, and I think we're going to start to see them become much larger advocates for the industry. You know, perspective is everything. like the HSBC signs in the airports, you know. It's like looking at energy investments, for instance. Like, Peyto generated $37 million in third quarter earnings, and while on the surface that might not look like much, when you put that into perspective relative to the rest of the industry, you see that we generated more profits than any other oil and gas producer in Canada. I mean, all of a sudden, that $37 million looks pretty exciting. So, you know, that's the kind of perspective I think that's needed here by our governments. And I think once our political leaders have gained that perspective, I think their positions on the Alberta energy industry are going to change, and they're going to change for the better.
Okay, thank you. Valerie, I'd like to turn the call over to questions from investors and representatives of investment businesses.
Our first question is from Brian Christensen with Dundee Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Morning, guys. A question for Darren or Tim. If you could provide any specifics on where you've been purchasing land, and then if you mentioned the 38 sections last year, 51 this year, would you expect the same or better in 2016, given a sort of strip-type environment?
Well, I can start, and Tim can throw some color in there. We've been buying all our land in Saskatchewan. No, I'm kidding. You know, our land strategy has always been one of picking up drilling islands, really. We're advantaged in Alberta, obviously, because all of the geological information, all of the drilling information, all the production information is pumped out into the public domain as quickly as it's gathered. So we have a lot of data to work with. You know, Dave and his team can do a ton of evaluation of data prior to us ever looking at putting out a dollar on land. And so we're pretty strict when it goes into land sales, just buying what we believe to be drilling prospects at the end of the day. So we don't carry a lot of extra acreage, which is good because that extra acreage is costly, but we selectively pick certain sections. And typically, we're obviously levering off of our strengths in terms of our infrastructure, where we've got gas plants and pipelines and leases and roads and all of that. That obviously makes the development of any prospective drilling location even cheaper. And so, you know, we're picking away at the edges of our existing core areas. And then, you know, any exploration initiatives we've got, we're slowly building up critical mass in some of those too. And we don't tend to talk about those too much just because we don't want the competition. But in our core areas, you know, we're slowly adding to the areas in terms of the peripheral, the next adjacent section. And then we're slowly adding in terms of rights as well. So you got to think about these big areas in three dimensions. We've got, sometimes we've got shallow rights that we're adding deeper to. Sometimes we've got deeper rights that we're adding shallow rights to. But, you know, I don't think we've really bought a lot of large blocks. You know, a few sections here, a few sections there, basically tacking it on to a lot of our core areas.
And I would add on, too, we're still disciplined in our land sale approaches. We identify parcels, pieces where there are definitely locations that we could drill. We have a set kind of price that we want to pay for, and sometimes competition blows us away, and there's nothing that we can do about it. It's happened a few times, you know, where companies have paid just exorbitant prices, like in Brazo area, and just kind of shake their heads, just move on. There are other initiatives, like I talked about, in terms of we're always looking at adjacent landholders. With us being so active, we're able to use, for example, those license validation credits to pick up additional pieces at no cost. So we're always looking to tap on and add on pieces for as little cost as possible.
And you know, Brian, I mean, we've picked up 51 sections to date, but really when you look at the inventory that's on those 51, because we're just buying drilling locations effectively, you know, we've more than replaced what we've drilled to date. So, you know, in just that little bit of activity, we've managed to secure new locations to replace what we've harvested this year.
And just, I guess, on that industry countercyclicality, would that suggest that there's going to be more locations to buy in 2016, essentially?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're not afraid to be aggressive there. Like you say, this is a good time with little competition for us to pick up inventory. We have to be a little bit cognizant of the term and tenure. We have a lot of inventory already in-house. And so, you know, knowing that there's a 5-year timeline on new leases and new licenses, we have to, You know, we have to think about when are we going to get to those and can we get to them in time relative to all the other opportunities that we already currently have. So, you know, we can be a little bit counter-aggressive or counter-cyclical at this point in time, but we can't get too crazy either, or we're just going to have a whole bunch of lands expiring on us in 5 years. And, you know, that's a waste of capital, so we don't want to do that.
And then maybe just lastly on, you've obviously got quite a big inventory, but and you've grown exclusively, almost exclusively through the drill bit to date. But if, for example, a large package, say from Husky, were to come up on the street, is that something you'd consider, or would it still be buying inventory through land and chipping away at your existing inventory?
You know, our strategy is fundamentally premised on return. That's why we invest capital, is to generate a profit, and it's the only reason we invest capital. If there's an opportunity to generate competitive profit to what we're doing organically with an acquisition, then we would certainly look at that. And we do. We do lots of evaluations. We send out lots of bids. And all those bids are premised on the fact that between the acquisition cost and the subsequent development capital that we have to spend, we'll generate a competitive return in total on those dollars to what we can do organically. Clearly, then, our bid costs tend to be kind of low, and we don't get accepted very often. In fact, once, I think, in a 17-year history for anything sizable. So, you know, it's that discipline, right? And we're not going to apologize for it. We're here to invest shareholder capital to generate a return for no other reason. So we're never going to stray from that discipline. We'll continue to look at everything that comes down the pipe that we think has opportunity on it, that we think has the potential to generate low-risk returns, but we're going to be disciplined.
Great. Thanks, Ed.
You bet. Thanks for the questions.
Thank you. Our next question is from Travis Woods with TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everybody. Question is just focused on Brad. You talked about some land purchases through Q3. Subsequent to Q3, have you purchased any more lands within that region specifically?
We did do some purchases, land sale purchases in Brazos. There were acquisitions that were done prior to this year that have supplemented our land base there. New locations that Dave was talking about to the west, we picked those ones up a couple of years ago.
Subsequent to Q3, though, has there been any land activity? I don't think
so.
No, not in Brazos.
Okay. And then is it fair to say that the full cycle cost on these wells specifically are a bit inflated just given the front end work that needed to be done?
A little bit. You know, the new areas like Brazos, and when we pushed our way down into Ansel, you know, our infrastructure footprint is smaller. Obviously, there's not as many leases we can extend or drill from. We don't have nearly the same road or pipeline infrastructure. So, yeah, the new construction is a bit of a front-end burden. I mean, it's not hugely material to the well costs, but it's something, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars extra per well in some cases. And obviously, when we're putting a grassroots plant in new areas, then it's a little more expensive, obviously, than an expansion. And then some of the trunk lines, you know, we built a big line connecting the south portion of the land to the north portion of the land and the plant, and that has sort of a heavier weight to it. But, you know, I think Brad's now to the point where we do have a fairly sizable line headed out west that's going to be a big piece. But, you know, once those sort of backbones get built, then subsequent development does get cheaper. There's no question. And I think, too, we've had some learnings in Brazos. It was a newer area for us. It had different stresses in the rock. There was a little bit of learnings on the drilling and completion side. We quickly got over that, and, you know, our costs there have come screaming down. So the wells are way more profitable today, which is great.
Okay, so if I compare it to it's called the Wilrich at Sundance, rather, if you call that a $4.5 million full all-in cost versus you guys are quoting 5.3, or do you feel comfortable that 5.3 will trend to be sub 5 or closer to 4.5 through 2016 to help that full cycle IRR compete with the Middle Flare, the Wilrich within your core Sundance area?
Yeah, you bet. Plus, you know, I think the well results we're getting in Brazos are stronger. a little bit too, right? So we get to complement maybe initially anyway a little higher well cost with a little better well result. So, you know, the returns tend to be preserved. But yeah, we're, you know, in each and every area, it seems like the longer we stay there and focus and continue to develop, the, you know, the more efficient we become, and the lower the costs are that we can drive down in those areas. And the larger presence we have in an area, the, you know, more efficient it gets and the cheaper it gets. So, you know, generally you would think that that we combine that with maybe a deterioration in the quality of the wells that we're drilling, and that holds our returns at the same level or preserves our returns. But, you know, I think when you look at this year's drilling, for instance, we're not seeing a lot of deterioration at all. You know, in many of the areas, the wells are just as good as they were in the first years that we're drilling, and the costs are obviously way down. You know, Dave talked about several hundred locations that are unglamorous. It's exactly right. It's the bread and butter, but the bread and butter isn't getting worse over time. It's staying as good as it was from the start.
Okay. Thanks for the time.
You bet.
Our next question is from Fay Lee with Alvin Brown. Please go ahead.
Thanks. It's FI here. In terms of the funding shortfall for next year, is $150 million a good ballpark number for that shortfall?
I think probably it's around that, Fi. I mean, obviously, we've got to make some commodity price assumptions, you know, some assumptions on our production volumes about, you know, I think we're not as concerned, obviously, with restrictions on production in 2016 as we were in 2015 with respect to TransCanada. Hopefully, that's not misplaced. And I think, you know, we see the forward strip and we see how low it is, and we can't imagine, you know, how much lower it can really go on gas prices without there being a lot of increase in consumption, coal to gas switching going on. I think we're already seeing that in the U.S. at these levels. So, you know, I think we feel like we're protected somewhat, that we're bottomed out a bit. But, you know, I suppose it could always go lower. We've seen it go lower at for short periods of time, and say 2012, gas hit $1.50 in the summer. But, you know, all those things considered, I think the funding shortfall is easily manageable with the balance sheet that we've got. But, you know, we're always checking returns. That's the thing that's driving our capital program. Obviously, if commodity prices fall too low, then the returns are going to start getting squeezed, and some of the stuff that we would be proposing to do today, we might not be proposing to do in 6 months from now if the commodity prices dropped off too far. So, you know, it's a very dynamic situation. And as Lee alluded to, you know, when we get another downturn in commodity prices, we see the service industry tends to tighten their belts even further, and we get some cost reductions too. So, you know, there's this sort of constantly changing relationship between costs and commodity prices, which tends to mitigate really the shortfall for our funding. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we do have a funding shortfall, and we're not, you know, pretending we don't. We could quite easily, with the cash flow that comes off 100,000 barrels a day at these commodity levels, hold ourselves here, pay our dividend, you know, not grow and not increase, you know, our debt, for instance. We've run that model. That's easily doable with the capital efficiencies that we have. But we've also got an opportunity here. And if we did just that, we wouldn't be taking advantage of the opportunity. The opportunity is to crystallize some well costs at this $3 million level, and we don't see that coming along very often. So why wouldn't we do that? Why wouldn't we take advantage, drill as many $3 million wells as we can with the available funding that we have, and lock that down? Because, you know, I don't think anybody believes that that's going to last forever.
Okay. So based on your current projections, your plan, that's built around certain assumptions, that let's say that the shortfall is in that $150 million ballpark. What is the current plan in terms of funding the, like, are you going to, in the press release you talk about having the capacity to do it with your bank lines, but is that the plan as it exists at this point, or do you, is that subject to further consideration, or how are you thinking about funding the shortfall based on your current plans at this time?
Yeah, I think we easily have the capacity in our bank lines. Interest rates are very cheap, obviously, and so the cost of that capital is cheap, and it wouldn't put us offside at all. We would stay within normal sort of debt cash flow levels. Our total debt relative to our producing asset base would still be only a fraction of that value. You know, I think we'd still all be very comfortable with that. If there's other forms of funding that would come along that would compete with that, then we will look at those. Specifically, you know, if equity was to be competitive with that cost, then we would look at that, I guess. And I don't think, you know, any shareholders would begrudge us looking at lowest cost forms of external capital that we can get our hands on. But, you know, those are always discussions we have at the board level and at the management level, and we're constantly looking at that. You know, none of this $600 million is going to get spent all tomorrow. We do it in small increments throughout the year, organically, drilling wells, monthly investments. So we can constantly be monitoring that external cost as we go. We're only very slowly taking on that incremental amount of debt over time. So, you know, we get to, it's a check and balance we get to do all along the way. You know, we're not spending all 600 and some million dollars on January 1. So, you know, we don't have to have necessarily that external capital all locked down on January 1st, for instance.
Right. It's very hard to compete against short-term interest rates given where rates are at this point. But would you consider terming out the debt or maybe extending your credit line beyond 2017 at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. And we have, right? We've got about half, not quite half, of our total debt of $1 billion termed out, $420 million of it, at very competitive rates. Again, we're looking for the lowest form of capital, right? The lowest cost capital. So is revolving debt cheaper? Does it have any, you know, fees associated with it for renewal year over year over year? And how does that compare to, say, term debt? And I think the term debt that we've done to this point has been very competitive with our revolving debt. And so we're more than comfortable terming it out for 7 or 10 years and keeping a balance of debt in our portfolio that's like that, some with a little shorter term and some with longer term and some of it revolving. You know, I think with how strong financially the company is, there's no risk that we're not going to have our revolver renewed and maybe even have some capacity added to it. So I think, you know, we've got lots of capacity. That's not the issue. I think the issue is we want to take advantage of the lowest cost, and we'll constantly look at that. And the markets are always changing, right? Interest rates are always changing. So we want to keep an eye on those, which we do.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Thanks, Clive, for the questions. Great questions. Great. Well, thank you very much for everybody for listening in and participating in the conference call today. Again, another great quarter by the team, and we're not done yet. We're still drilling away. We've got 10 rigs running. We're extremely active going right through to the end of the year and into next year. And, you know, we haven't really changed our pace at all. We want to stay aggressive in this environment, as we alluded to, and I think we have more than enough capability and capacity to do that. You know, we're looking to probably exit the year hopefully more than 100,000 barrels a day, since we've already hit that mark already, and we're going to be adding more producing wells to the end of the year. But we'll stick with the 100,000 for now, and hopefully by the end of next year we exit at around that 110,000 to 115,000 level. So we'll have expanded our production base even more, and I think 2016 looks to be an exciting year for us, for everyone here at Peyto. So stay tuned, and we'll come back to you with the year end and reserves at the end of the year and some more year end analysis in February and March. Look to the monthly reports that go up on our website to see how we're doing on a monthly basis. Thanks again for tuning in.